There is nothing so wonderful in the world as telling stories.
Tous les matins, on essaye de traverser le miroir et de regarder le monde différemment.
It is true, I am a woman.
Une fois que ce saut est fait, tout devient possible.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Casaraghi. Welcome to the podcast of Les Rendez-vous littéraires Rue Cambon, a place where we meet to talk about writing, to talk about books. Let's meet women writers who have just taken their first step, the most decisive, the most difficult in the world of literature. How did their vocation call to them? What are their writing rituals? Who reads them and what do they read? And today, Erica Wagner will be hosting Ingrid Persaud.
I'm Erica Wagner, and it's my pleasure to introduce Ingrid Persaud and welcome her to Chanel's podcast of Les Rendez-vous Littéraires Rue Cambon. Ingrid's first novel, Love After Love, won the Costa First Novel Award in 2020, but she was winning prizes long before that. She won the Commonwealth Short Story Prize in 2017 and the BBC National Short Story Award in 2018. Born in Trinidad, she read law at London School of Economics before later studying fine art at Central St. Martin's in London. Her writing has appeared in many venues, Granta, Prospect, The Guardian, National Geographic, and Five Dials, to name a few. I can't wait to talk to her today. Welcome, Ingrid. It's marvelous to be here with you.
Thank you for having me, Erica.
In this first section of our podcast, we're going to talk about your vocation as a writer. And I want to know about your relationship with writing. What made you a writer?
I think it was a process of elimination, trying to find an outlet for my creativity that somehow connected my hands and my heart. And I tried fine art, and that did some of it. It introduced the concept of play, but it wasn't quite there. And I really sort of fell into writing because we'd moved to Barbados, and I sort of lost my art tribe. I'd been in London, so the kind of London art scene, wearing black, trying to be cool, hanging out at galleries. And then I got to Barbados, where most artists were painters, and they were doing sort of large, colourful narrative paintings. And I can't paint to save my life. And so I kept sort of trying to do something creative and failing miserably. Like, I'd ask at the petrol station if they wanted an artist in residence, and they said, you know, lady, just pay for your gas and go, please. And so that wasn't terribly successful. And so I started writing a blog, and I gave myself the task of writing 900 words to be published by 10 a.m. on a Friday. And that was my Notes from a Small Rock. And I did that for 3 years. I think that's really my apprenticeship.
And that gave you, we'll talk a little bit more about your practice later on, but it sounds like that helped develop your discipline.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with discipline, really, because the Presbyterians got me early. So I went to a Presbyterian primary school, a Presbyterian secondary school, and we really didn't do fun. We did discipline.
But your writing, I should say to our listening audience, is tremendous fun. There's a marvelous sense of play and enjoyment in all of your writing, and certainly in Love After Love. I want to talk about your early influences. I've heard you mention a book called The Year in San Fernando by Michael Antony, also V.S. Naipaul's A House for Mr. Biswas. Both of these books, I think, made strong impressions on you. So I'd like to hear a little bit about why. And I also wonder about Derek Walcott, because your wonderful debut novel shares a title with one of his poems, which contains the line, "You will love again the stranger who was yourself."
I think I should preface what I say, Erica, by something more personal, which is that I'm the child of sort of lower middle class parents who were, you know, are descendants of indentured laborers. And education means everything. And there are three options. You know, you can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, or you can be a failure. And so the idea of being a writer just wasn't part of the deal. And so when I tell you about early influences, I'm telling you about just my love of reading, which I got from my mother. She absolutely let me read anything I wanted. So it wasn't that I was honing a craft from a long time ago, but what I did enjoy reading more than anything else were voices that spoke to my local experience. So, you know, on the one hand, I was a kid growing up with Enid Blyton and reading, you know, about girls playing hockey and living at boarding school and having midnight feasts. And then I read A Year in San Fernando, and I was living in San Fernando, and I could recognize the street names. Then I was about 13 when I read A House for Mr. Biswas, and I could see echoes of my own family, or at least a society around me. And when I read Derek Walcott, I suddenly realized that the beauty that I thought was the privilege of something foreign and unattainable was actually just around me. It was the beach and the sand and the people and the chaos and the mixture, that too could be beautiful. And so that's what Derek Walcott gave me.
The idea of creating beauty didn't exist in some other world, but could be very close to you, if I understand you correctly.
Yes, because the beauty was elsewhere before. The beauty was in reading Hardy or reading, you know, Lawrence or Virginia Woolf. It wasn't in something that I could see and feel. It wasn't in what felt like, we have a word called commis. And commis means that things are just not well arranged. It's disarrayed, taken to a certain degree. And that's what my life felt like. And that's what my surroundings felt like, with the heat and the dust. And nothing was terribly well laid out in the way that beautiful English gardens might be. It was a bit wild. And so to find that that was both acceptable and could be a source of inspiration and beauty and happiness was a real eye-opener.
You talked about your parents and this idea that you could be a doctor, a lawyer, or a failure. You did study the law.
Yes, because I'm a good girl, and I wasn't any good at sciences, so I, you know, I just looked at law. I was like, there's nothing else I can do. So I rock up at London School of Economics, and I look around, you know, and within a month or two, I realize, these are not my people, and I'm never going to be one of them. But what I did also discover is that I loved university. And if you stay long enough and you sort of give them enough fees, they give you bits of paper. And then if you really won't leave, then they give you a job. And so I could just kind of continue just pretending that I was in the law, but actually I was just having a lot of fun hanging out at university, and that's where I want to end up again.
But there must have come a point where, and in your familial context too, where you accepted your vocation, that you weren't a failure and you were going to make your life in art, in writing. What did that mean to fully step into that?
Oh, you make it sound like it was a terribly brave and courageous decision. No, I hid it. I didn't tell my parents till ages, you know. And I took 6 months off from my academic job as a law professor. And I thought that it didn't matter what you did for 6 months of your life. And I saw advert for Art Foundation course at the Slade. So I rocked up there and I said, I'd like to do this course. And they said, where's your portfolio? And I said, well, I don't have one, but I'm terribly enthusiastic. And they hemmed and hawed and they said, well, I guess you haven't learned any bad ways, so we'll take you. And at the end of that, it was awful. It was a baptism by fire. But by the end, I found myself saying, I want to do a degree in fine art. And so I had to go off and get an HNC in art, because that's like the equivalent of an A level for grown-ups. And off I went from the top of the food chain to being denied access to the library, because they said I had to take a course first on how to use the library and the Dewey Decimal System for labelling books so that I'd know where to find them. So that told me where I was at. And then I don't know what my parents told people when I was doing an art degree. I think they probably said she was having a vacation or something. I they certainly didn't own up to it. And then I made matters worse by, you know, that whole thing. I was back at university. I was having a good time. And so I just wanted to stay. So I went to St. Martin's to do a master's, and I wouldn't leave. So they gave me a bit of a part-time job there too. You see the pattern.
I do see the pattern.
But it was, I think, you talked about stepping into one's vacation. So with writing, I think it was easier because the first thing I write and the first kind of experience of me as a writer, I win a prize. And so if you take a prize home at any age, it's really good.
And that was actually going to be my next question, because your wonderful story, The Sweet Sop, won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize and the BBC National Short Story Award. So what did winning those prizes mean, not just in your family, but I also think for you, for your confidence and desire to continue to step forward?
Winning the Commonwealth Short Story Prize was really significant because people were calling me a writer. They were saying, oh, she's a writer of short stories, even though I had just the one. So I had to sort of, you know, pretend that there's just one of many, you know, that I'm going to be churning out. So other people were calling me a writer. And the prize also endorsed a particular type of writing, which is writing in Trinidadian English. And that felt really significant, that I could write in the voice that I was kind of stepping into, and that it would be okay, that other people would understand it. So that was really significant. And then winning the BBC National Short Story Award was even more significant, because the BBC put, you know, a lot of PR behind it. So it's a big prize in the world, and it's 15 grand as well. So it's a significant prize. But the first thing I was asked is, you know, who's my agent? And of course, I didn't have an agent, so I did the whole, I'm just a poor thing from an island and I've just got the one short story for me. And so I had all these agents lining up, and they were like, oh, we'll take you, we'll take you. And I said, that'd be lovely. Could you just slot yourself into this spreadsheet here? I've got 10 days and I'm going to interview all of you. So I interviewed everyone and I told them I wouldn't choose until the end. It was the most amazing experience, from having, you know, I think like the week before I'd won the BBC Short Story Award, one agent had set up a meeting with me and cancelled me on the day. And her email said, I have to cancel because I've got to meet someone important. She also congratulated me afterwards, but I didn't reply.
That'll teach you.
Yeah. So I interviewed all of these agents and I ended up with the magnificent Zoe Waldie at RCW. And yeah, the rest is history with that.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more question about that history, because I want to know a little bit about the publication of Love After Love, when you found out that your novel was going to be published, what that felt like, because that's another step forward after winning these prizes to come out into the world with a novel.
I gave Zoe 20,000 words of Love After Love, and she said, this is fantastic. I think that you really got something here. And when can I have the rest? And I gave it the rest to her 3 months later. I wrote like a banshee. And I think it was her enthusiasm of the first 20,000 words that helped me and made me sure this was something that would fly. And I soon discovered, you know, that she carries a lot of weight in the industry. And she said, you know, I've got all of these publishers who are interested, and we need to go and see them. And I thought that we need to go to see them and pitch to them. And so can you imagine how weird it was to show up at the first pitch where I had researched every person in that room, only to find that they were pitching to me. And one of them had baked a sweetbread. And there was this homemade sweetbread. And she said, I've used the recipe from your novel. And then I got a bottle of rum with my name on the label, Persaud Rum. And I was like, oh, this is nice. So we went round to lots of publishers. And Faber, who I ended up with, they merely served pastries from the local deli. And I said to them, you know, your competitors did home-baked goods.
And where's my rum?
And where's my rum? And I could see Louisa going, man, if only we'd gone to that bakery in Brixton, you know, we'd have it in the bag. But so all that to say that it wasn't like a huge surprise, but it was very exciting. You know, it went to a 7-week auction, and I thought, you know, I'm going to make enough money to retire forever. Well, that didn't quite happen. But, you know, I got more money than I've ever got for anything, because I hadn't written anything before. So I was very pleased. I've ended up at a publishing house that I have great support, and I love being there.
That's wonderful. Well, now I think we'd like to hear a little bit of Love After Love, if you'll read for us.
Sure. So I'm going to read Love After Love is a book about homemade families that come together. And these three people, Betty, her son Solo, and their lodger, Mr. Chaitin, come together to form an unconventional family, broken apart by a little too much rum and some secrets being spilled. And the rest of the book is really how they perhaps come back together or not, and how they find themselves. And it's really about themselves. And it's narrated in their three voices. So there's Betty, Solo, and Mr. Chaitin. And I'm going to read to you from the first chapter, which is in Betty's voice. And she's interacting with her husband, Sunil. In tutus, I dished out the stew chicken, vegetable rice, and green salad. Sunil used the fork like it was a shovel. When he's like this, anything can become an argument, and any argument can become a fight.
Like salt cheap?
But I hardly put any salt in the food.
He rocked back in his chair. If looks could kill.
You telling me you cooked this chicken and didn't put one set of salt in the pot?
Silence.
So what I tasting? Something must be wrong with my mouth. How I tasting salt so? You know my pressure high and you giving me salt? Like you want to kill me? Eh?
I was careless. I'd left the rolling pin on the drainboard, easy reach of Sunil's chair. That rolling pin might have hit the wall or the bed or the chair, but it found me. Doctor said the ulna and the radius snapped in two. My arm was in a cast when we buried Sunil a week later. At the funeral, I told people it was no big deal. I must stop being so careless with ladders. But I took half and left half. People used to look at me and Sunil and say, Betty girl, you're real lucky. In my head, I wanted to ask if they're making joke. Lucky? That man only gave love you could feel. He cough you down? Honeymoon. He give you a black eye? True love in your tail. He break your hand? A love letter. He put you in hospital for a week? Love will stay the course. He take a knife and stab your leg? Until death do us part.
In the next section of our conversation, I want to ask you a little bit about your writing process. I want to know a little bit about your habits and rituals. Are you an early in the morning person, late at night? Do you have any talismans that you keep on your desk? How does the process work for you?
You know, every writer gets asked this, and I think it's because we're looking for some special alchemy that exists, some magic that brings it all together. And there's no magic. You have to get rid of all distractions and you have to sit at your desk. And so I've got rid of quite a lot of distractions. My twin boys are old enough to have flown the nest a bit at uni. And the other half got rid of me, so that freed me up with some time as well. So I'm alone, and I've got a dog called Bob Marley. And if I have any talisman or critic, it's Bob Marley, because I do read what I write out loud to him. And if he doesn't yawn or go to another room, I feel, well, you know, there's something there. And
that's an unusual first reader, I'm going to say, in my experience of talking to writers.
Yeah, he's a tough one. And I used to be an early morning person. Now I'm just a all the time person. I'm writing with a kind of feverish energy, and I'm writing all the time. So I'll write till 3 in the morning. I'll get up at 7. I'll have a cup of tea, have some cereal, and then I'll start writing again. And I just kind of sleep as much as I need to and eat when I need to, and have this incredibly privileged space of not worrying about anyone else. And also because, you know, I'm an old biddy, and so I've got to write. I've got to just like get all the books out of me. You know, I didn't start young enough to allow myself 20 years to write the second book.
So you've got some catching up to do.
I do indeed.
Do you feel? I want to ask you about your use of language. The Trinidadian English you write in is so rich and distinctive. What do you think about the way in which what is called standard English has been privileged in literature?
It's been privileged in literature, and it's astounding that it continues to be privileged when it is the English of such a small minority. And therefore, to me, that is what's astounding, rather than the fact that I'm choosing to write in the English of millions of people who live in the Caribbean. So it's odd that we've adhered to that standard. And I just didn't think it was authentic to what I'm doing, because my setting is Trinidad, my characters are Trinidadian. Why wouldn't they speak as they normally would? And then why would I write the prose in a different register from the dialogue that was so alien? I didn't want that sort of setup that therefore pitted one English against another. And I thought that once you write with clarity and integrity, people will understand. So I don't translate, I don't explain, and I do it with, I hope, enough enthusiasm that people are won over.
And what does it mean for you in this novel to write in the first person, to let the characters tell their own stories?
Because these characters were all journeying to themselves and I was telling very personal stories, it seemed natural to do it in the first person and to have each narrator allowed a moment. It was easier to do it in some voices than others. Ironically, the men were easier voices. And I know that some women writers find that odd because they can inhabit female voices better. But I think that my ability to inhabit male voices and male persona, at least more easily, is really a natural outcome of the fact that women are always attempting to go into spaces that we are barred from. And so we're always imagining and placing ourselves in these spaces that we can't occupy. So when I had to go to Betty's voice, someone much closer to myself, that was really difficult.
How do you edit your work? Do you redraft as you go along? Do you wait till you have something complete? What's that process like for you?
I edit as I go along. So a paragraph could take a day. I try not to let it take a day, but it can do. My first draft tends to be quite an advanced draft. Advanced in the sense that I've got rid of the obvious silly things that creep in, like someone enters a room in chapter 5 but leaves from a different room the next chapter you see them. So I get rid of all those little inconsistencies. I try to deal with the voice. I try to really struggle and get the voice right. And I try to get the plot right. And so subsequent iterations are about honing in, getting the nuances in place.
Do you have any trusted early readers, aside, of course, from Bob Marley and perhaps Zoe, to your wonderful agent?
So Zoe is someone, you know, I treasure every criticism she gives. She's so encouraging. But apart from Bob Marley and Zoe, I have a secret weapon in Luke Nima, who is the deputy editor of Granta magazine. And Luke, I met because he published The Sweet Sop in Granta in 2017 or whenever it was, and was really so encouraging. And he's remained, I would say he's my first reader, and he is my most trusted reader.
But I think it's interesting what you say about the importance of that early reader, because writing is often seen as a completely solitary process. And of course, so much of it is solitary. But there does come this point where the feedback of someone who really understands you feels like a collaboration.
I do. And I don't like the idea of being celebrated. Yes, I wrote it. And yes, I spent, you know, many, many months alone with my thoughts. But a book is such a long collaboration. It starts with Bob Marley and Luke and my mum and my trusted friends and Zoe. And then when everyone I trust around me feels it's okay, then it goes into Faber and Louisa, my wonderful editor there, and Nicole Counts at Random House in the US. She puts her oar in. And then there are the copy editors and so many other people that it really is a team effort that comes at the end. And I think people forget that and they prefer the myth of the lone genius, you know, writing. That's definitely not me.
In the final section of our podcast, I'd like to ask you about the reception of this wonderful novel. The New York Times called Love After Love a stellar debut. Gabriel Bump, the author of Everywhere You Don't Belong, wrote that it was a big-hearted prose narrative about an unconventional family, fear, hatred, violence, chasing love, losing it and finding it again just when we need it most. What kind of reactions did you get to the novel? And I wonder maybe what reactions meant the most to you?
Gosh, so this is spilling, you know, my heart a little bit. But your review, Erica, in The Economist was the one that I think ultimately meant the most, because it was the very first one and I knew it was coming. And Zoe and I were literally at the laptop refreshing the page constantly to see if it would be panned or what was said. And that was the most meaningful. And the one that I remember most, and the one that I cut out and, you know, sent around to everyone. After that, I was okay. I thought, The Economist likes it. I'll be all right.
Maybe this is going to be all right.
And then maybe it's going to be all right. And so the others started coming in and I was just really lucky. I was just, you know, there's always an element of luck that somehow the book touched people maybe at the right time when they needed it. You know, there's so many things that go into a good reception, and chance is part of it.
I wonder, did you hear from readers? Did you get any response from the public, or when you've done readings, have people come up to you and told you their stories? I wonder how that's been.
I do a lot of reader events because I think the book is nothing without its reader. You know, it isn't completed without a reader. The book goes and hopefully a reader touches it and it touches the reader. And really, it is that process that makes the book. And so I give a lot of time to book clubs. I'm always inviting myself to book clubs. I read on Twitter, you know, we're reading Ingrid Persaud's, you know, Love After Love. And I jump on and say, can I come? Can I come? And, you know, with Zoom, I can do. In fact, one book club in Philadelphia wrote to Faber and said, there's someone impersonating Ingrid Persaud who wants to come to our book club. So that was kind of funny. So I've had a lot of positive feedback. I've had some heart-wrenching letters, not many, but a few, of people who've suffered, women who've suffered from domestic violence. I've heard from parents whose children have self-harmed and they found the bits on self-harm difficult to read. So I get a lot of positive feedback. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there isn't a lot of negative feedback out there, but I don't go seeking it. So I don't read like Amazon reviews or Goodreads or anything like that. I just assume that if it's really nasty but it's something I can learn from, somebody's going to bring it to my attention. Otherwise, nah, not bothered.
I think you're working on something quite different now, historical fiction, I believe. I wonder if that gives you perhaps a different perspective on Love After Love. You know, it's published a little while ago now, and you wrote it before that. When you think back to this, your first novel now, what do you think?
I think how naive, how brave to have just gone in not knowing anything about the industry, or because it is a commercial process. And I had no idea about anything. I just thought, you know, you write your best and you hope for the best. Now I know far more about it, at least. It's not that I'm jaded, and it's not that I'm not trying to write the things that I want to write. I think what drives me now is that because I don't think I have lots of time, I want to experiment as much as possible with each bit of writing that I do. And so I was writing a novel that felt, you know, I was on familiar ground. And then I was asked to do a nonfiction piece. And I did it on Boise Singh, who is a notorious Trinidadian gangster, serial killer. He was the godfather, sort of taken up a notch or two. And I sort of fell in love with the material. And I ditched the novel I was writing and have had to learn how to handle historical material. And I've had to engage in a sort of different set of research and sensitivities. And I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
I'd like to ask you about the reception of your work in the broader sense as well, because you've spoken about the importance of greater equality in the publishing industry. Tell me what you mean by that and how you think it can be achieved.
Greater equality is, it's in two strands. The first is about the voices that are allowed to be heard. And I have to say that Faber were amazing. There was never any pushback. In fact, there was no pushback from any of the houses that bid for the book. So they understood that good writing, a different voice, they can make something of this. And since then, we've had so many new voices come through. So we're definitely seeing a moment where publishing houses are taking, I wouldn't say they're taking greater risks, because they are publishing excellent work that stands up and is award-winning, but they are open, at least, to lots of new voices coming through. So long may that continue. But there's a second strand to the industry which is slightly overlooked. If you write a book about the Caribbean, you might find yourself tucked away on a shelf at the back of the bookstore under multicultural literature or travel literature or something that has nothing to do with your work. And so it is a process of educating the whole industry that actually a book like Love After Love is literary fiction. It doesn't belong on the shelf with romance, and it doesn't belong in the back with multicultural voices. And it definitely isn't a travelogue or a cookbook. But, you know, that takes time and persistence. So I have gone into bookstores where I have removed my book from the inappropriate shelf, taken it up to the counter and said that I'd love to sign the copies for you, because if you sign it, they can't return it. So there's some royalties. Then I suggest where they might shelve it. And of course, they're too embarrassed to do anything differently.
Or indeed, put it on one of those nice tables at the front.
Oh, yeah. I always put it on the nice table just to show them what it could look like.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, we're going to close our talk. It's been so marvelous speaking to you. We have a few quick fire questions for you, which we ask all of our guests. And the first one is, what is the most surprising thing you've learned from being a writer?
This one stumps me. And, you know, it's joy. I didn't expect to be so completely happy. And I'm not talking about the fact that I don't have to come out of my pajamas most days. It's that I am truly happy, that it's a body, mind, spirit kind of coming together happiness.
And while we're on the subject of surprise, what would people be surprised to learn about you, other than that you read to your dog?
I ran the New York Marathon. Yeah, babe. I am an endurance athlete, okay?
That is really cool. Excellent answer. Next question. What is your idea of perfect happiness?
So this one's hard. I mean, I'd like to say world peace, because that would make me into a much better person than I am. But actually, so there are two strands to this happiness, okay? So if my kids were happy and fulfilled, gosh, I would be so happy, because I wouldn't have to worry about them. So that would be amazing. But assuming that, you know, there was world peace and my kids were happy, it would be a book, a glass of something, a hammock and a beach.
Very good. What advice would you give to anyone who wants to express their creativity?
I'd say borrow from the Stoics. Memento mori.
We're gonna die. You're gonna die soon. For goodness sake, don't put it off. Just do it. Just do it. Just sit down. Just do it. You know, don't mind that, you know, what people are gonna say about you and, you know, what you're gonna say about yourself. Just do it. Today. Now.
And then in one word, how would you like to be remembered as a writer?
Inspiring.
I like that word. I like that word very much. We have a final question, which is, what would you like your second novel to look like, to be like?
I'd like it to be a surprise.
Returning to the theme of surprise. Well, thank you so much, Ingrid Persaud. I'm so thrilled you could join me on Chanel's Literary Rendezvous podcast. Until we meet again, this has just been wonderful.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rendezvous Littéraire Rue Cambon podcast. To discover more about it, you will find images, links, and references on the Chanel website. À bientôt!